Okay, tonight is Tuesday night, October the 9th. Lael, 28th day of the month of Tishrei. This is a special shiur sponsored by Neirot on the topic of Bishul Akum.
Okay, Rabotai. I want to thank everybody for coming. What I'd like to do tonight is to focus on the issue that I have been asked to speak about, the issue concerning Bishul Akum. And what we're going to do is see the original source of the prohibition in the Mishnah Maseches Avodah Zarah, a very critical Rashi, and then certain halachot in Shulchan Aruch with an eye towards being very practical in terms of this particular rabbinic prohibition. The situation that we're describing has nothing to do with kashrut per se. The issue that we're talking about is not going to be where there is any doubt that the Gentile is cooking something that might be problematic in terms of consumption. That would be a totally different situation and would obviously touch upon many, many biblical prohibitions. If a Gentile were to prepare a piece of meat and you had no idea where the meat came from, obviously this would be a 30-second shear. You're not allowed to eat it. End of discussion. Why? Because it might be nevela, you know, meat from which came from an animal that died from anything but a kosher shechita. Maybe it was a trefa. It had one of the eight physical defects that render an animal trefa. And you're not allowed to eat trefa. You're not allowed to eat nevela. You know, maybe it was cooked in a milchic pot. So there'd be no questions about anything in terms of its consumption. So the assumption that we're operating on tonight is that there is absolutely no question in our mind that the product that is being prepared, either in your own personal home or in a store, is beyond any shadow of a doubt, is 100% kosher. We know it's 100% kosher based on the fact that it's your home. And once it is your home, you have a halachic right to testify that anything that is in your home is indeed kosher. Because if you didn't have that halachic trustworthiness, your husband or your children would not be permitted to eat in your own home. The halacha grants you, every single individual, every single person in Klal Yisrael, a chezkat kashrut, that which they are serving and offering to you is indeed kosher, if a family, if an individual is personally observant. And the same thing's true on a communal level. Somebody is, way before everybody decided to be suspicious of everybody. On a communal level, if a frugal person opens up a restaurant and says that which I'm serving you is kosher, you have a right to believe it. And I'll be there, you're allowed to eat it. The only issue that we are discussing tonight is the fact that this super mahadrin meat was prepared by a Gentile. And a rabbinic prohibition has been created for us not to consume that which we call bishulei akum. So the Mishnah, you have the sheets in front of you. The Mishnah in Masechet Avodah Zarah, I bracketed the relevant phrases for us each and every time. And then the critical Rashi says the Mishnah, "Ve'elu dvarim shel ovdei kochavim asurin." Here is a list of those items prepared by a Gentile, which are prohibited. "Ve'ein isuran isur hana'ah." The prohibition only includes a prohibition against eating, but not against deriving benefit from it. There are many situations where the Torah prohibits not only consumption of the product, but even deriving benefit. What might be the most famous example of something that which you're not allowed to eat, but you're also not allowed to benefit from? Anybody know? What? Chametz. Exactly. Not permitted to consume chametz, not permitted to benefit from chametz. Same thing is true of anything cooked in milk, milk and meat that are cooked together. The Torah writes, Lo tibashel gidi b'chalei b'mo, three times. Once to teach us you're not allowed to cook it. Once to tell me you're not allowed to eat it. And the third time to tell us you're not permitted to engage in commercial enterprise. You're not permitted to derive a profit from it. These items that are listed in this particular Mishnah are only prohibited in achilah. You're not permitted to eat the prepared item, but commercial enterprise deriving a profit from it is perfectly okay. And the reason why the Mishnah makes this statement is on account of the fact that this Gemara, from which this Mishnah is taken, is Masechet Avodah Zarah. And a good part of the Masechet deals with activities which an individual engages in as an idolatrous sacrifice, offerings, gifts to pagan worship, to pagan gods. All of those activities, if I take wine and I pour it, la'avodah zarah, yayin nesek, if I offer any sacrifice unto a pagan god, it is prohibited not only to be eaten, but you are not permitted to derive any benefit from it. You can't give it as a gift. You can't sell it. So here, the Mishnah decides to let you know that as opposed to the majority of the Mishnayot that are deal in Masechet Avodah Zarah, that deals with things which are not only prohibited to be eaten, but also prohibited to be benefited from, to derive benefit, this Mishnah zeroes in and focuses only on something, only on prohibition of something that is asur ba'achila, but mutar ba'hana'a. So a Gentile who happened to cook something in your house, and we'll see what happens, which is under, and it happens to be something that is prohibited, you would not have to throw it in the garbage. You could decide to sell it. You can give it as a gift to somebody because there is no isur hana'a, only an isur achila. So the Mishnah says, "Ve'elu dvarim shel ovdei kochavim asurin ve'ein isuran isur hana'a." So the Mishnah is going to name many things. We're going to see, we're only going to focus on one, but I'll just get to the one that we need. Chalav shechil bo ovdei kochavim ve'ein Yisrael roehu. Chalavakum. Milk that was milked by a non-Jew, and no Jew supervised it. This used to be a major problem. I'm going to spend a lot of time on this, because it's not our issue tonight. It used to be a major issue. That if you had milk, produced milk by somebody who's a Gentile, you and me are not permitted to drink it. That's one thing. Today, you're allowed to drink chalavakum. Why are you allowed to drink chalavakum? Because the two greatest poskim of our generation, the Rav and Rav Moshe, both believe that since milk today is produced under government supervision, there is absolutely nothing to be worried about if you get milk, you know it comes from a cow. It's not going to be pig's milk, not going to be anything else. But nonetheless, so we don't have to worry about that today. We don't have to worry about it today. We're not talking about chalavakum. Next. Hatatz. Bread that is baked by a Gentile. Pasakum. Not permitted to eat it. V'hashemen shelohem. And oil. Oil produced by a Gentile. You're not permitted to use. Okay. Rebbe u'beit dino heitiru hashemen. Rebbe and his beit din said that shemen is permissible. Certain times in history it was prohibited. Rebbe said it is permissible. Again, each one of these I can spend a whole 2 hour shiur on it. It's not our focus. Here comes the key word. Lahashlakot. Shlakot is a Mishnaic term for something that is overcooked. Bishlu is something that is cooked appropriately, and shlachot is something which you really, really overcook. Okay. So if you a Gentile cooks something or overcooks something, you're not permitted to eat. The Mishnah doesn't say why not. Why not eat something? Again, it's made in your house, kosher utensils, kosher food. Why can't you eat it? Take a look at Rashi. I bracketed the Rashi on the left-hand side of the page. The hashlakot. Everybody have the price? Bracketed Rashi. Kol davar shebishlo oved kochavim v'afilu bikli tahor. Any item cooked by a Gentile, even if it is in kosher, pure utensils, you're not permitted to eat the product. Vikulu, and all or many of these prohibitions in this Mishnah are for one reason. Mishum chatnut. Take a stab at chatnut. What do you think it's related to? Chatnut. So what do you think what do you think? Correct. Social interaction with the Gentile. We are looking to minimize social interaction. Because if you are going to engage socially interaction with the Gentile, what might happen is you strike up a relationship. And then if you strike up a relationship, who knows how far that relationship is going to be carried further. As a result, what might happen? The unthinkable. Some Jew will decide to marry this Gentile. So because of the concern that food medium, this has not changed since Adam and Eve were created on this world. Food is often a medium of social interaction. So if this Gentile is going to prepare a wonderful meal for you, he'll sit down and oh, what a meal. And then you say, yeah, that's good. Want to run a movie? Yeah, and you know what happens. So therefore, in order to prevent this type of social interaction, the Rabbanan prohibited the consumption of any item that was cooked by a Gentile. Mishum chatnut. Again, it's not a concern of its kosher. Of course it's kosher. If you provided the food, you provided the utensils, it's kosher. But the Rabbanan prohibited it nonetheless. And there are half a dozen other things, which are all based on the same under the same address, chatnut. Now, often the rabbis they don't make up things out of their they just wake up in the morning one day and say, I'm going to create this. They saw a potential model for this in the Torah itself. In Parshat Kitisah, which describes the transgression of the Egel, after things have calmed down, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has said, Hashem Hashem, Kel Rachum V'Chanan, I will forgive. V'salachta la'avoneinu l'chataseinu l'chatan, phrases that we've heard 50 times over Yom Kippur. HaKadosh Baruch Hu reminds Am Yisrael, and Moshe reminds Am Yisrael, I want you to be very careful about certain things. When you come to Israel, and we now take over the land of the Canaanites and so on, I want you to be very careful. Because it's not going to happen, poof! Today, it's all Arab. Tomorrow, it's all Jew. That's not the way it's going to happen. The transition, the takeover, the conquest is going to be a slow one. And if it's going to be a slow one, there are going to be times when you will be living in Tel Aviv and your neighbor is going to be a Canaan because we haven't succeeded in getting them to leave yet. It's our land, but we haven't yet succeeded in getting them to leave. So the Torah says, be very, very careful. I don't want you to become a little too friendly with them. And the Torah says the following. That one day, v'kara l'cha v'achalta mizivcha. He will call you and invite you to his feast.
says Rashi, is kosher. He's going to slaughter it exactly the way a Jew is supposed to slaughter it. It's glatt kosher meat, prepared with brand new utensils, so that you will find it no resistance whatsoever to what? To come and accept the invitation. The next pasuk says, you know what? Don't intermarry. The next pasuk says, don't worship their gods. So there is a progression that the Torah somewhat concerned with. Social interaction could lead to a more permanent, long-lasting, more sophisticated relationship. Once you have a relationship of an intermarried couple with a pagan, what might the beautiful young lady ask you to do? Can't you come to church with me today? Can't we go slaughter together in this pagan temple? I'll come to shul on Saturday, and you come to the church with me on Sunday. And therefore the Torah says, be careful. I don't want you to partake of this. So the Torah itself provided somewhat of an inkling that this happens to be accurate. Therefore the rabbis now legislate, and they make an ironclad rule. Anything prepared by a Gentile Jew boy is not allowed to eat. Now, thank God that the Gemara goes on to qualify and limit this particular prohibition, and that's what we're going to focus on tonight. What exactly is included in the prohibition started with the Rabbanan, and what is not included in the prohibition? If it would be a blanket statement, there'd be nothing that you could purchase. For example, you want a cup of coffee. Can you just go into Starbucks and get a cup of coffee? I'm not talking about flavored coffee. Regular cup of coffee that was cooked by a Gentile. Can you go there? The answer would be no. If we would have to continue shirk. But since there are many, many different criteria, we will see what exactly are the criteria which are now included in the prohibition of Bishul Akum, and what type of things the rabbi said are not included in this particular category. So flip the page, and you have a photostat of the Shulchan Aruch. Not a handbook, a book, you know. This is the real book. Shulchan Aruch, we'll see it straight out of the Shulchan Aruch itself. There is one siman in Shulchan Aruch, in Yoredeya, which has all of the laws of Kashrut in it. Number 113, Kuf Yud Gimel. And we will see there are 16 sub-halachot. We're going to do eight of some, about half of them, and we will get an entire picture tonight. So you look at the first words of the Mekaber, where it's next to the Av. He starts off by saying, Davar she'eino ne'echal kemo shehu chai. Something that is not eaten when it is raw. In other words, in order to consume this, what must happen? You must cook it. Vidam, second criteria, it is oleh al shulchan milachim. It should be something worthy enough that if a dignified guest were to come to visit, you would be inclined to serve this individual, this particular item. Oleh al shulchan milachim, lilafet bo et hapat. Somehow to serve as in addition to the main part of the meal. The main part of the meal in the time of the Talmud was always bread. So anything would be considered something to add above and beyond the bread. Open parteret, or as a side dish, shebishlu oved kohavim, which is Gentile cook, afilu bikli Yisrael, even in Jewish utensils, ubebeit Yisrael and in a Jewish house, Asur Mishum Bishulei Ovei Kohanim, is not permitted to be eaten based on the rabbinic concern of Ovei Kohanim. Right? Now, the Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber, he's not here to explain why, background, that's not his job. He's here just to explain the actual bottom line halakha. So if you look on the top right hand of the page, that's one of the commentaries, the Kaz, he explains it. He writes, look at the top line on the right hand page, I bracketed it. Hata'am, the reason is, the Ikarah Seira Mishum Chatmut, that the reason why the prohibition was created is on account of the fact that it's going to promote social interaction. V'davar she'eino chashuv kol kach. But something that is not really significant, ein adam mazmin chaveiro alav. If you have something that's not terribly significant, is this the way you're going to attract somebody? Is this the way you're going to make a great impression? Let's sit down and have something, and you give him something that's, you know, that you wouldn't bother serving your dog. That's not something that's going to attract much attention. So therefore, the rule of thumb is that it must be, in order to be considered prohibited, it must be something which is considered chashuv, something significant. There will be three or four criteria to determine for us what is considered chashuv and what is not. Two have already been stipulated. Number one, something that has to be cooked. If a product can't be eaten raw without cooking, the prohibition of bishulachim does not apply. So if you are making the greatest applesauce on the planet, the best applesauce recipe you can think of, and a Gentile cooks it from top to bottom, you're allowed to eat it. Why are you allowed to eat it? Because you can eat apples raw. So it makes no difference if the apple is cooked. Since the primary ingredient is an apple is eaten kemoshe huchai when it's raw, therefore the isur of bishul has no application of bishul apple. That's why you're allowed to have a coffee in any coffee house on the planet. Why you're allowed to have a coffee house in any dining room? It was cooked by a Gentile. Because the main ingredient of coffee is water. And water can be drunk without cooking. So, even though this particular cup of water was cooked, it's not subject to the prohibition of bishulach. The rule number one is that it must be davar shehuchai. No, a davar shu'eino nechal kishuchai. Something which is conventionally not eaten in the raw. But if it's eaten raw, even if it happens to be cooked by a Gentile, it doesn't apply. Plus, the most important criteria will be that it has to be something significant. Something worthy of presenting to a distinguished guest. And I need a real distinguished guest, because the expression is, Oleh al shulchan milachin. It's worthy of being presented to what? On a king's table. So there is no doubt, ladies and gentlemen, there is no doubt that if a Gentile were to cook a chicken and mashed potatoes, and string beans, that's a thing that he would serve a very decent guest. There's no doubt about it. And it undoubtedly should not be consumed. But if you'll ask me, is it a little macaroni and cheese for your little pitchers at home? I'm not sure that's something you would want to serve, macaroni and cheese, if you had a distinguished guest. So that might be something that is 100% perfectly permissible. But let's take it one step at a time. So, two criteria so far. That it's Oleh al shulchan milachim. Number two, it has to be something which generally is consumed only through the cooking process. Through the cooking process. If you'll, in halacha bet, the Machaber says, what happens if you have a combination of things? You're making an apple kugel. Now the apples are eaten raw, but the rest of the ingredients are not eaten raw. What happens under those circumstances? What dictates and determines whether Bishulakim will apply? Rice in the Kaber. Irei davar hane'echal kimo shehu chai. Im davar she'eino ne'echal kimo shehu chai. Ubishlam ha'ovei kochavim. If you mix, if you have an ingredient, make a kugel, a cholent, with certain things that are eaten raw, other things that are generally not eaten raw, how do you determine whether or not, and a guy cooked it, how do you know whether to determine whether it's prohibited or not? Im ha'ikar midavar shiyesh po mishum mishu le'akum, asur. If the primary ingredient is something that is subject to bishulakum, then it's prohibited. But if the primary ingredient is something with what? Which is eaten raw, and not subject to the prohibition of bishulakum, then the entire mixture is permissible. Okay? So anybody want to give me a little shreishin? You're the chefs. Give me an example of something that has ingredients, several ingredients. Some of the ingredients are only eaten when the product is cooked, and other ingredients have ingredients in them which could have theoretically been eaten raw. So give me an example where the main is one and the main is the other.
Deli roll.
Deli roll. Okay? Deli roll has what?
Right.
Okay. Well, deli meat was cooked. Wasn't it? Initially, deli meat was cooked. Now, you don't just take it from an animal and eat it. No, you don't have deli roll coming straight from an animal. What? An apple pie. Okay? Good. Apple pie. So you have the pastry on the bottom, which generally must be baked in order to eat it, and then you have apples. A very good litmus test would be, what bracha do you make? Right? So if I eat apple pie, I make borei priyates. Because the apple is considered, at least in many opinions, apple is considered the ikar. In which case, a Gentile who prepared an apple pie, I would say, is not subject to bishulakim. If you believe, however, that the main part of an apple pie is the crust, then, and you would make borei miyem and zonot on an apple pie, and a Gentile prepared it, he's not permitted to eat. Why? Because the determining factor is what is considered the ikar. What is considered the ikar? So, here you have an example, perfect example. Yes?
If you have soup, vegetable soup, is the main ingredient water or is it vegetable?
Okay, excellent question. Again, what bracha would you make on vegetable soup? What bracha would it? Somebody's vegetable soup, what bracha do you make?
No.
You make borei
priyadamah.
Even if it's puree, you make borei priyadamah on soup, on vegetables. I would say that if it's carrot soup, carrots can be eaten raw, no problem. If it's potato soup, it cannot be. People don't eat potatoes raw. So you have to determine in such a thing what's considered the ikar. Again, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because that's not going to, but just giving you a guideline. Whatever is considered the ikar would make the determination as to whether or not it is subject to bishulakum or not subject to bishulakum. Yes?
Right now, are we talking about stuff that's been cooked in our houses as opposed to eating out?
Yes. Before you said, I'm talking about eating, what do you mean?
Before you said something about it,
In your house.
Yeah.
Yeah, a guy cooked an apple sauce in his house. How do you know it's cooked? How do you know he didn't put in something that you're not allowed to eat? Talking about, it's 100% kosher. Yes?
I just have a question. I was thinking of the preparing. Is that one and the same? Like, the ingredients are most of them are...
Something that has to be cooked.
Right.
There is no prohibition whatsoever for the Gentile to cut the potatoes, pour the beans, slice the meat, nothing whatsoever. We're talking about cooking. Cooking means putting it on the flame. Yes?
Wine. Obviously, it might be fit for a king, but in theory, wine, what is wine? It's grape. There is cooking when you make wine.
Correct.
So, technically, is that okay? So, you have a vineyard in the back,
and the Gentile takes it and makes it into wine?
Yeah.
So then, it's a very good question. So, first of all, wine grapes are not consumed. Wine grapes are designed only to be made into wine. So if a guy happens to cook the wine, there is another whole halakha about yayin. And it has a different origin. So even though your question is a good one, wine per se has a different situation based on what we call stamina. And therefore, it's not really part of our discussion tonight, but there are other issues with yayin, even if a guy doesn't cook. If a guy just handles a bottle of water, a bottle of wine, you're not allowed to drink it. Handles it. Unless it's mevushal. That's correct. So yayin has a different origin to it. Yes?
Apologies if you addressed this earlier, but the term used is obey for coven, which is usually a person in worship that brings up.
Correct. No, absolutely not. That is correct. It's the standard term that was employed, Bizman HaMishneh, Bizman HaTamid HaShulchan Aruch, which was written in the late 16th century. That's the terminology that is always used. Akum. Good. Yes. Okay. Go down to Halacha Dalet. Here is a critical statement. Critical statement. Why do I say this is a critical statement? In light of the reasons for the prohibition. I don't think anybody here has somebody in their house with whom you have a real social interaction who's going to be sitting cooking meals in your house. I really don't think that's the case. If you have a very good friend who happens to be a Gentile, who's going to be sitting in your house cooking away. The cases for which you all came tonight is because you have help in the house. And these are not your social peers. So, in reality, do I think, or should the halakha think, that anybody here is going to establish a relationship with any of the help that is working in our homes? Slim in them. So let's see what the Mechaber writes. Yeshmi, this is the Halacha Dalet, last two lines of the Mechaber in the middle of the page. Yeshmi shematir bishfachot shelam. There are those who say that if you have a shivcha, a maid, that's okay. The maid can do all the cooking. The Yeshmi shall say, and there are those who prohibit it. I feel a bit the other, even if it's already been done. So it happens frequently. The Shulchan Aruch quotes two different opinions. Now you have to know the style of Karo. So now if you read this, now what do I do? And this is a critical halakha. So the rule of thumb is that whenever Karo quotes two opinions, he believes in the first opinion, but in deference to someone else, he quotes the second opinion. You have to know, again, a little background about Karo. Rav Yosef Karo didn't create the Shulchan Aruch in a vacuum. There were already halachic works that had already coded Jewish law well before Karo was born. And Karo decided to take three different codes and said, I'm going to paskin the halakha, I'm going to formulate the halakha like these three. If there happens to be any debate amongst the three, I'll take two out of three. The three who we identified was Maimonides, the Rambam, two, the Ritz, Rav Yitzchak of Fez, and the third one is the Rush, Rabbeinu Moshe. Those three halakhic giants served as the basis for power. Now, Rambam and Rif were both of Sephardic origin. The Rush is the lone Ashkenaz boy. Therefore, whenever there is no unanimity, when there is debate and dissent, 90% of the time, it's Rambam and Rif on one side, and the Rush on the other side. Anybody here of Sephardic origin? Okay. You have the good fortune that you follow Kabbalah. Because Rambam and Rif formulated the absolute, unadulterated halakhic principles. Not many chumras. Not many. After the Mechaber quoted his halakha, and the Ashkenazic Jews said, we got kind of lost in the shuffle here, because it looks like he formulated the halakha based on Sephardic tradition, which is absolutely correct. So then the Ramah, who in the Shulchan Aruch is the Rashi print, like in the middle of those two boxes, I didn't read the Ramah because it wasn't real, where it says, in the middle of Beth and Gil, you see that Rashi print in there?
Yeah.
That's the Ramah. What the Ramah does is, he defends us Ashkenazic Jews, and says, oh, that may be the Sephardic tradition, but Ashkenazic do it differently. 99 out of 100 times, when the Ramah says something against the Mechaber, he's being machmir against the Mechaber. The Mechaber states a position of leniency, and the Ramah writes, v'yesh no'agim, but we Ashkenazim, a machmir. Literally 99 out of 100 times. So right here, Karo writes, let's get back to our case, yesh mi shematir b'shvachot shalom. There are those who say that our type of shvachot, the prohibition doesn't apply to them. Others say it does apply. So now I've given you enough information to know that Karo, when he gives two opinions, he believes that the first one is correct. Now, how would you define a shivcha? Who constitutes a shivcha? I would have been inclined to say yes.
Someone
you pay. Oh, someone you pay. However, take a look at the bottom of the page. Take a look at the bottom of the page, and they, all of the commentaries say absolutely not. In biblical Hebrew, how do we, in the Torah, when it mentions the word shivcha, what does it mean? What does it mean? What? No, no. A slave. Correct? A shivcha is a slave who you owned. You bought her. Correct. Like an eved. An eved, you have an eved kina'ani and a shivcha kina'ani. Says the Targum of the Shach. It's on the, if you look, you know, it's right over here. It's bracketed in one of the commentaries. I bracketed it for you. Vishvachot shalom. Perush, what does it mean? Hakinuyot rov. Who are owned by us. Who muzharin anu al milach kran v'shabbat min ha-Torah. Biblically, we are not permitted to ask them to do work for us. Biblically. It's the pasuk in the Aseret HaDibrot. Lo ta'aseh kol malacha. Who's not to do work? Ata. Ata refers to every man and woman over bar mitzvah. Bincha u'bitecha refers to your minor children. You are not permitted nidda oraita to ask the child to do a malacha for you on Shabbos. Says the light's on, you can't tell your two-year-old to turn off the light. That's an isur de oraita. And the Avdecha, the Amalecha. That refers to a Gentile slave and a Gentile woman slave who happens to be owned by you. You are mid-de-oraita, not permitted to ask them to do malacha for you on Shabbos. An ordinary Gentile who you don't know, there's no isur mid-oraita. That's only Mizrabanan. That's Amiran Anachli Shlut, Mizrabanan. So all of the commentaries claim that that which we claim there is no potential of social interaction is a, what do we say here? It's because what? You own them. And generally speaking, the class distinction between master and slave was always taken care of, was always guarded. And therefore there was no concern whatsoever that there would be any social interaction between the master and the slave. Hence, if my slave cooks something for me, there's no reason to prohibit it. Because I don't think anybody is going to strike up a social relationship with their slave. However, this has no relevance to us. Because none of the people in our employ are our slaves. They can walk out tomorrow morning, as they often do. Right? A slave, you own it like a piece of property. You're not allowed to free a slave. But ever can I? You're not allowed to free a Gentile slave. You're supposed to work for them, and you're supposed to inherit them for all future generations. Very strange all come. So those who would say that it doesn't apply now to situations, it doesn't appear so from the text, that this qualification of Shrachot only applies if you actually own them, not if they are in our employ. So if they are employees of ours, the prohibition of Bishul Akum will still be in effect. Will still be in effect. But, so now, is there any way around it? Any way around it? So there are several suggestions that are made. How the rabbis will allow you to engage in taking advantage of a product cooked by a Gentile, and yet you want to be loyal to this particular reason. One of the ways in which the Chachamim came up with is called Yad Yisrael Be'emza. The Jew had some hand in the preparation of this item. The Jew had some hand, some direct involvement in the preparation of this item. And here we're going to see another interesting debate between Karo and the Rambam. And this is one of the one time, as opposed to 99, where Karo is stringent and the Rambam is lenient. So look at on page C. It's Halakha Vav. The next page, Halakha Vav. Yeah, of course. No, the Rama never said, the Rama never disagreed with Kala. But the Yesh Nisho said. We don't know who they are yet. Yes. That some claim that even with a real slave, the Vishal Akka would still be an issue. That's correct. Correct. Right. The Ramah just adds that the Ashkenazic practice is to rely on the first opinion, and that if you have a real slave, the prohibition doesn't apply. That's all the Ramah is. Let's take a look at what Karo writes. Kol shebishlo Yisrael me'at bishulo. If a Jew does something in the participation of this food preparation, vein b'tchila, bein b'sof, whether it's in the beginning of the process of the cooking or at the end of the process of the cooking, then it is mutar. Then the prohibition of bishul akum doesn't apply. Lefikach, im heiniach ovei kochavim basar o kideira agabei ha'esh. A Gentile put up a piece of meat to cook or anything else to cook. Ve'hafach Yisrael bibasar vehegis bikdeira. Right? Let's assume you're broiling the steak. So, it's on the broil section in the oven. So what do you often do? You turn it over. Or you're grilling. on your grill. So first you, then you flip it over. Well, flipping it over is some involvement. Or you are, sometimes you have to, the ingredients say, or the recipe says, you know, stir every 10 minutes or something like that. So if you stir before the product is cooked, and you stir it, juice stirs it, that's okay. That's called Dab Yisrael Be'emecha. Then, so if a Jew started, or the Gentile finished. A Gentile started, a Jew boy finished, prohibition doesn't apply. Why doesn't it apply? Because what's happening here is that the halakha knows that this is a very difficult halakha to always accept. So we're looking to really minimize its potential. And the only time that the Rabbanan prohibition will apply is if the Gentiles prepared it from beginning to end. But if there is any Yad Yisrael Be'emza, that's not enough. Now, what famous thing did I not mention?
Turning the ovens on.
Turning the ovens on. Caro doesn't recognize that. Caro doesn't recognize that. That turning on the oven is not sufficient for Caro. You have to actually participate in the preparation of the item itself. So you couldn't turn on your stove before you went to work at 7 o'clock, even on low, and the Gentile will raise the flame at 3 hours later and cook the greatest meal of all, roast beef and everything. Good. According to Caro.
What comes to presentation? If I just brought something
in the brain, so now, preparation in the cooking process. In the cooking process. Not that you basted it, not that you put the pepper on. In the cooking process only. You have to do something in the cooking process. That means once it's on the flame. Once it's on the flame.
Chopping the onions and mixing the ingredients
is not. If it's on the flame. That's Caro. He has the stringent position. However, what? Absolutely not. Reheating is worthless. Once the product has been cooked, it has already been subject to be shalakim.
What if you fully cooked it and maybe heat it? So reheating it.
That is not the prohibition.
Even if you wouldn't eat it, so
that is correct. Once it's been cooked. It is cooked. If it's been cooked, once it's been cooked, it is no longer subject to bishalach. That's correct. Yes?
So, he doesn't raise the issue of turning on the oven.
He does. He says the next halacha doesn't work.
Right, so if someone needs to not turn on the oven in order to heat something up that has already been fully cooked, that's not a problem.
That is correct. Absolutely not. Yes.
If someone is going there to go and get an OU kosher dinner, has that been in the factory been prepared in the hand of a Jew in some place there?
Of course. Of course. The role of the mashkiach in most kosher establishments is to do one thing. Turn on the flame. Rest of the night you go to sleep.
Like Morningstar Farms and all of those things?
Any commercial plant which has Jewish participation in the production, the Jew does one lousy thing. He turns the flame on.
Why can't we do that at home?
You can. I'm going to get to it. I didn't see the Ramah yet. I was first started with the Maccabi. Yes.
What about something that's not like to go on a shulchanah, like
okay, so we're going to have to, we'll quibble with that a little later. Right? We'll quibble with that a little later. Yes?
What if you bought like floating mushrooms? Nobody makes, they were, you know, all you do is heat them up.
If they've been fully cooked, not subject to bishalach. Because it's reheating. Not a problem. Yes?
There's something that seems so ironic about the whole halakha, because the Jew and the non-Jew almost working together, it seems like it is
That's the greatest form of interaction. I know.
So,
your point is very well taken. Very much. That here where there is a cooperative spirit, Jews who do it, there's nothing to worry about here. It's only if the guy does it completely. You're right. It sounds a little unusual. I don't have a good explanation for it. Yeah. Correct. Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
I think someone else was mentioning this also, but earlier you were talking about macaroni and cheese for your little picture.
Right.
So
I like what you
said. It was your word.
Yeah.
When you get back to it, we could talk about what happens if there's leftover and you come home from work an hour later. Is that now?
So I'll get to it on the last page. I'm going to get to it when I come to the last page. Where the Makadr is going to give an illustration, which I would have thought is not Oleh al Shulchan Aruch, and he claims it. So we're going to have to talk about it in a second. Yes?
What about Pisa?
What about Pisa?
Well, they're not fully cooked, though.
They're not fully cooked, then it's subject. We'll see. Is a Pisa bit? Okay, that's a product. I want to reserve this discussion on which product is subject, which is not subject, to a little later. Yeah.
Chicken soup left over from Shabbos. Sunday I have a cleaning lady or slave, whatever you want to call her.
It's been cooked before Shabbos.
I put it into the microwave and push the button.
Of course.
That's okay.
Because it was cooked already.
Okay.
Leftovers are okay. That's correct. If you don't serve leftovers to a king. Right? How many times has your husband cooked for you? Wednesday. Right? Yeah. Well, no. I know.
No.
It's because it's already been cooked.
Right,
that's correct.
To do with
the correct.
Okay. What about something that's cooked in the microwave?
Okay, that's...
You press the button. Something that's cooked in the microwave.
No.
Okay.
No.
That's like the oven.
We are going, even though from a Hilchos Shabbos, there's a whole debate about whether a microwave halakhically is considered cooking. There are those who believe, I shouldn't say too loudly, that microwave is not halakhically cooking, because there's no eish. No eish. No mayim, no eish. And as a result, it would appear from some Rishonim that microwave cooking might even be permissible on Shabbos. I'm not saying turning on the microwave, but if it's on already, for you to put something in, according to some, it would be permissible. Because halakhically, it's not called cooking. I'm not saying that's the side-ish. I'm saying it's on, you dismantle the light, like you do with the refrigerator sometimes. It's just the issue of the microwave cook. The Rav always believed that microwave is an Issa d'Oraisa based on the fact that what was considered, the discussion came about if somebody cooks something in the sun. Okay? You went and, like, everybody, it's so hot, you can fry an egg on the sidewalk. Okay, so that's what you did. You went outside, took an egg on Shabbos, and exposed it to heat or sun, and the egg was fried. Are we allowed to eat it on Shabbos or not? The answer is you're allowed to. Why? Because ein derech bishul v'kach. That's not the way most people cook. So therefore it was not included in the prohibition of bishul. Ein derech bishul v'kach. That's Rashi's explanation why bishul v'kama, that cooking something directly in the sun is 100% mutter in the Gemara. Black or white, no one disagrees. So the Rav said that in today's day and age, where it has become the derech to what? Cook in a microwave, even though it doesn't have the phenomenon of fire, therefore it holds. Today is the derech, and therefore it's awesome. Other Rishonim claim that the eish component is an integral part of the definition of bishul. And as a result, without it, there is no cooking on a d'oraisa, certainly not on a d'oraisa level. But from our point of view, we're not going to entertain that. Microwave is like anything else. Now, in Halakha Zayin, Carol writes that turning on the flame, throwing in a match, is worthless. Ein shkirat ha-ta'anur mo'elet. What does shkirat mean? Pirush havara. Light the fire. Carol says that's worthless. The action of the Jew has to be in the cooking process directly related to the product. Now look, the last two lines, the Ramah. The Yesh Cholkin, and there are others who disagree with Karo, who Sviralu, what they believe, the Hadlatat Ha'esh, or Chitui Gichalim. Either kindling the fire or stirring the coal, don't forget they had coal ovens at that time, Mahani Le'inyin Bishul, it works, and that's the way we conduct ourselves. So in any major establishment, where all the chefs working, all the help are Gentiles, what does the Jew Mashkiach do? He turns on the flame. That's all he does. Once he turns on the flame, it's already considered Yad Yisrael Be'emsa, and he can cook the most elegant 50-course meal that you would like. So if you're not worried about conserving the gas, and not worried about the PSE&G bills, if you just turn on the flame in the morning, you can tell the guy, prepare whatever she wants. No problem. It sounds like a terrible loophole. But again, the prohibition is rabbinic, and often, this is not the first time, it's not going to be the last time, rabbinic law, when it's applied, has very, very strict parameters. And if it doesn't fit exactly in that parameter, it's automatically permissible. It's not something uncommon in Jewish law. So our lives are made considerably easier by the Ramah's decision that Yad Yisrael Be'emsa includes not even touching the pot, not even touching the ingredients, just turning on the flame. Yes? Before it is completely cooked. Now, here now comes the question is, what's considered completely cooked?
Not edible?
So, does anybody know what standard do we use for defining cooking for Shabbat purposes? Let me ask you this question. No? Here is my test case. I come home Shabbat morning after shul, and I want a fresh chicken. I turn on the oven. I put the chicken. The oven's on. I put the fresh chicken into the oven on Shabbos.
Raw
chicken. 2 minutes later, I said, you know, I got to be a good Jew. I take the chicken out of the oven. I violated the use of cooking on Shabbos and baking on Shabbos on that.
No.
Correct. Why not?
Because
it's not cooked yet. So what do we define as cooking in a halachic sense? It doesn't have to be mevushal kol tzarva. It's called ma'achal ben drusoi. Drusoi was Al Capone. The Al Capone of his time. There was a gang called the Druzy Gang. Now they were on the run all the time because all they were doing, they were robbing, they were thieves. And they had no time to wait until their food was fully cooked. So they ate food when it was one-third cooked. One-third? That's called ma'akal, cooking, ben drusoi, like the Druzy gang. Strange that halakha would now take such essential definition from Al Capone's gang, from the mafia. Some claim, and we'll see, we'll have to come to this resolution, some claim that's the criteria as well. At what point is the item considered cooked? So that it's already too late for the Jewess to come and make the stir, if it's already reached its halachic cooking point. halakhic cooking point has nothing to do with the visual called sarco. It's one third complete. Once it's already one third past the recipe time, you are finished. Yes.
Now we may come up to this, you know, next few mishnayot that you talk about, but you have to also turn on the stove top before you the burner, and your stove top is considered the same as the oven. You have to turn it on as well.
Electrical gas, right?
Yeah, electrical gas makes no difference whatsoever.
What about the pilot?
What?
What does the pilot?
Okay, that's an interesting question.
My next question.
I don't have to answer that question because today no ovens have pilots anymore. Right. What happens if the pilot is on and if you with the pilot, I'll see then we pass in, that's enough. That if you have an oven with an old-fashioned pilot and you, the Jew, lit the pilot, even though the other burners are not yet lit, the Gentile can turn it on because you lit the pilot.
Even if you lit it...
6 days ago. Yeah. 6 months ago. That is correct. Yes?
Is there a distinction between Judas and Judas? Are they connected to the Shomer and Lachar?
No. Justice to be Jew boy. That's correct. No one else. This is a distinction between Jew and Gentile. Not between Shomeresha. Why? Tell me why. Because the issue here is not... whether it's kosher or not. Correct. That's correct. If the issue of concern was the kashrut of the matter, then somebody who is yet to be committed and observant, that person would not have a lack of trustworthiness. But here, that's not the issue. The products are 100% kosher. It's just the chashash of it. Once it's a Jew, it's perfectly okay. Perfectly okay. Let's move to the last page for a minute. Here is a very serious consequence of not paying attention to the halakha. Look at the second bracket thing before we get to the first bracket thing on page D. Halakha tet zayin. Kelim shebishel bohem ha'ovei kachavim lefaneinu. Dvarim sheyesh bohem mishum bishulei ovei kachavim. Slichem hekshev. That's the kasha. All the utensils that was subject to the prohibition of Bishalach. So if a Gentile cooked something in your oven, kosher, cooked the chicken, get the kasher the oven. If you serve, if you use, she put it on what? On China, what are you going to have to do? Throw it out. Unless you can kasher China. No, if she did, if you had a product that was made which was subject to the prohibition of Bishalach, not only are you not allowed to eat the food, but all the utensils become asur until you kasher them. What? That's correct. But one second. A Gentile who cooks, that's correct. Anytime you have a Gentile cooking in your house, something that is subject to the prohibition of Bishul Akum, any cooking, the utensils have to be kosher. So if you had a Gentile who cooked in a pot, a chicken and potatoes, which is certainly qualifies as bishalachon, you have to kasher the pot, you have to kasher the silverware, and if they serve that in China, the only way to kasher China is to put it into a self-cleaning oven and see if it would stand at heat. And otherwise, that's what I'll say. This is done, this halacha is done as a farm, because the rabbis wanted to put some teeth into it. They deliberately took the hard road here. Why? That they really wanted to put teeth into their prohibition. So on the one hand, they're incredibly lenient. They will look for any type of an excuse not to apply the prohibition. But when it does fall into their confines that it's forbidden, it has very serious consequences. have to sit in the kosher, the oven, and then, to do your pots and everything is a real pain in the you-know-what. And as a result, they really believe that knowing this particular halakha will discourage one and all from violating this particular prohibition. This particular prohibition.
Did the Ramah say anything like that?
What?
Did the Ramah say anything?
No, the Ramah just gives a different case. The Ramah gives a case of what happens when it is perfectly permissible for a Gentile to cook. Anything is one case when a Gentile is allowed to cook for a Jew. For a chayla. Correct. If the cooking by the Gentile for the Jew is done with halakhic permissibility, then even if you, let's assume the Gentile cooked the whole chicken because this patient is ill. Now the patient only ate a quarter of the chicken. You're allowed to go ahead and eat the rest of it. Why? Because this act of cooking was not subject to the prohibition of bishulach. Why was it not subject? Because it was not designed, obviously, for fraternity. It was designed to take care of this person who's ill. So if it's done for a chola, under those circumstances, even if he cooked it on Shabbos, that's the Ramayana, even if the Gentile cooked it on Shabbos, for a Jew, if it's done for a chayla, it's automatically not subject to the prohibition of bishul akol. Bishul akol. Okay? Now there's one other halacha. Go back to the halacha right on top of that, and this is makes it a little fuzzy, a little nebulous, not as crystal clear as I would have liked it. Let's do surveys and... How many people would say that a hard-boiled egg is subject to bishul akol based on what we said tonight? You know my style. How many people, as survey says, would believe, based on what we discussed tonight, would you say is subject, would you say that hard-boiled egg is a soft-boiled egg? I would never have classified a hard-boiled egg as something shera'ui la'alot al shulchan melachet. I personally would not. Yes? Take a look at the Mechaber in Halacha Yudav. Baked up an egg, afal pi shera'uya l'gol ma'achaya, even though you can eat raw eggs, maybe the Karo was a chazan, and he believed in that nonsense, that raw eggs are good for your voice. Nonetheless, in Bishra, Ovei Kochavim, if an egg was cooked by a Gentile, Asura, it's prohibited. So Karo believes that a lousy egg is subject to Bishulach. A lousy egg is subject to Bishulach. You know what? Once Rav Yosef Karo and the Chagra makes that statement, this opens up a whole Pandora's box as to what is and what is not considered Olah al Shulchan Aruch. Now you can come with all of your questions. Are pizza bagels any worse than a hard-boiled egg? Is macaroni and cheese worse than a hard-boiled egg? I don't know. Again, my gut feeling is, and I'll tell you something, this is not an art, when Karo makes these types of statements, this is not an ironclad halakhic statement. What is he representing when he gives an example about an egg? What's he representing? His culture. Exactly, his day and age. In his day and age, maybe a hard-boiled egg was considered a davar kashuv, which they would necessarily be. After all, we use eggs symbolically in halakhic context very frequently. At the Seder, we have an egg to represent the Korban Chagiga. Did the egg all come through here? that the Seder, they have an egg to the Korban Chagiga. We just had three times, so you have to have an Eruv Tashilin. Even though it doesn't have to be an egg, but it can be any cooked item, but a lot of people do it the old-fashioned way. A piece of matzah, right, and a hard-boiled egg. We use, at a Beit Avel, it's often that you serve eggs. Erev Tisha B'Av, for the Sudah HaMaseket, we eat a piece of bread and an egg with ashes on it, you sit on the floor. So in Talmudic and Rishonim times, eggs, I can understand it, was a double kosher. It played a significant role in many halachic meanings. I don't think that an egg really plays that kind of significant role today. Yeah?
Might it also have something to do with the availability or expensive item at the time?
Might be. It might. It really might. Now, I'm not saying that an egg cannot be something that's really oleh al shulchan malachim. Somebody has a Spanish omelet, or an omelet like they have with Mr. Omelet, right? With lox and onions and everything like that. That's something which is something substantial. That I would assume, I would agree with Carol, even in our day and age, that if you had a distinguished guest for a breakfast, you're not going to be serving them a turkey sandwich for breakfast. So a nice Spanish omelet would be something that we do with now a servant. But just throw a hard-boiled egg at them, I don't think that would somehow fit the case. So now it becomes, here's where the shady part is. And, making the decision about pizza bagels or macaroni and cheese. To be honest, pizza bagels I don't think are oil of the shulchan aruch. I really don't believe it. Because you get any guest for dinner, even if you're serving a dairy meal, and you serve a guest, I'm not talking about the king, a guest. If you serve a pizza bagel, they're going to look at you, that's the end of the friendship. That's not the way you're going to make. So, the halakha would you want to make sure you don't have a guy in the front, serve a pizza bagel. That's not going to promote any ahava and kiruva whatsoever. And the same thing was with a little macaroni and cheese. I honestly don't think that really qualifies as oil al shulchan aruch. I'm not saying macaroni does. There are times when you prepare, if you go to the pasta factory and you get a pasta dish served with all those little things around the plate, things like that, sprinkle with pepper on the plate and so on to make it look attractive. That has a different appeal to it. That is subject to bishul akra. But I'm talking about that which you would serve to a kid, and you wouldn't serve it to your husband. I'm serious. If he's coming home for dinner and you're having a dairy meal, I don't think you'd slop down macaroni and cheese or a pizza bagel in front of him. I really don't think you would do it. If you would, don't ask your housekeeper to do it.
Can't the child be sort of like a cola in the sense that they can't do it for themselves?
No. The cholah is to be taken seriously, a cholah. The definition of a cholah is formulated by Havalah. Nafal l'mishkal is bedridden. If a kid's running around and he's not bedridden, he's not a cholah. Not a cholah.
Can a child be the one to
turn
on the other
mitzvah? I'm not 100%. Any time over bar mitzvah definitely works.
It would be under bar mitzvah.
I'm not 100% sure whether or not a 10-year-old can serve, I'm not sure, I have to check that, it's a good question. If you have a 10-year-old who you would trust to turn on the oven, I don't think you'd tell a 2-year-old or a 5-year-old to turn on the oven. If you have a 10-year-old to turn on the oven, a 12-year-old boy, that's correct. I'd have to check, I think it's okay, but let me just check on that. No, but the question is, since he's below bar or bat mitzvah, is that halakhically significant? I don't think it is. I think it is. It's okay. I just want to check that if the person, if it's a Jew, it doesn't. I haven't seen any place that has to be a Jew who's an adult.
Well,
are
you considered a Jew?
I'm not quite. I don't think it's a problem. But let me check.
What if you said the timer? You don't actually the box leaving early.
go to work. You don't want the oven to be on all day, and you told your cleaning room
to do what?
To make something at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The oven would automatically turn on by itself.
That's fine. That's fine. Setting the timer, as long as it will go on without the Gentiles pushing any buttons, that's fine. Because you did it. That's correct. Doesn't mean that you have to have it. Doesn't have to be ignition blast off right now. Yeah. Yes. Right. If you didn't know, the question is, if somebody had heretofore a Gentile cooked something for herself, right? Or even somebody came to the shir tonight, didn't know this halacha, that it renders your utensils, you know, if a Gentile ever cooked something in your house, it renders all the kalim prohibited. So what should you do? You should try to kosher everything. So here I'll tell you what to do. Even with China, the Ramah actually says elsewhere that you don't have to throw out China. Since this is a rabbinic requirement, it's not really non-kosher, because again, all these things are kosher. The Ramah says even by China, if you dip it in hot water 3 times, it's enough. So anything that can be koshered, let's say silverware, I would kosher. Take a pot, boil up the water, throw it in one at a time, that's all kosher. That's it. Let the water come to a boil, throw it in. If you have a pot that was used, as you know, let the pot fill up with water, let the water boil over a little, it's kosher. The oven, just turn on to the highest possible temperature for an hour or two, it's kosher. That's it. So if you wanted to cover yourself that some of these halachot had been violated in the past, and you would like to make sure that everything has been kosher, that's what I would recommend. Anything that can be kosher easily, just kosher. Anything which halakhically cannot be kosher, in this, let's say, plasticware, china, in this case, you're allowed to just dump it into hot water 3 times, and that's all you need. Easy plastic. Yeah. Yeah. What? No, but if like all the utensils that you serve with, let's assume they cook chicken and now you serve this on plastic, I don't know. You have plastic utensils. And then you wanted to use that plastic silverware again, right? Yes.
Yeah. What if you eat that stuff
then? Nothing. Tell you what you didn't do. Don't worry. You're buying shalom on the stage. Yeah. What?
I can actually, you know, this person knows milk car, inflation, everything is color coded and whatever. I can actually leave this person and let her or him take control of my kitchen without any worry about whether this person is going to mess up because she has messed up when I was there. Now I have to say something that a few years ago at Pesach, we have a friend of ours, and my babysitter has a friend who does cooking for people that are Orthodox, they're more modern, and they work. And she actually, this woman taught her how to make matzo balls, and for Pesach, I mean, she was cooking up the storm. She called my cleaning lady, my babysitter, one day to tell her that morning she was making matzo balls, and she thinks she made a terrible mistake. She put the wrong mix. It was not, she was told that she's supposed to use the non-kosher paper, but she used the wrong one. And she realized it. So she called up my babysitter, who happened to be, this was about 5-6 years ago. And she said, I need to talk to someone. I think I made a terrible mistake. She called my husband, she called Carl,
right,
to ask him a shot of what to do. I think she brought something out with her.
But I mean, what happens? I mean, how far do we go? I mean, what we, you know, here this mistake is caught. The owner, the person that lives there doesn't know what happened, has no idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, how far can we, you know, in reality, how far can we go?
If you see that things look pretty much in order, you can rely on it. If you find that things are out of order, if you find milk-licked silverware in the slushy dishwasher or something like that, you know, I would start, you know, asking lots of questions and not to trust her that much, because, you know, there's also a difference as to how they're going to respond as well. There is a halacha that mesiach l'fitumo is permissible. If a Gentile gives a response, just off the cuff, saying, oh, you know, I cooked this with this, and then you say, oh my God, it's the wrong thing, or I cooked it with this, and it's the right thing, you have a right to trust it. But if they're afraid by giving the wrong answer that you're going to fire them or warn them, then if you suspect something, they have forfeited all trustworthiness, and we assume, like every good person, that they're out to protect their job, and they're never going to give you the truth. So anytime you notice something irregular, that's when I would start worrying. If things look pretty much in order, and you tell them, look, when you cook meat, you have to be, you know, you have to do this.
Yep.
You know, if things look in order, you can assume that, you know, that they follow your instructions. I don't think they're deliberately going to mess things up. So, but usually you can tell, you know, we can tell when we ourselves make mistakes and we find milk-licked things in the place. With them, you're going to find that pretty quickly. Yeah. Okay. That's a good thing. You tell them in advance not to be afraid that their paycheck that month is not in jeopardy. Yeah. Yes. Right. If it's not subject to the laws of Bishalakha, then you're allowed to eat it.
Why does it not become for the own self?
Right.
Why does everything else become subject to
Bishalakha?
Is that after
not Bishalakha? Because in a Jew's home, the Seirah of Bishul Akum applies even if there is no direct evidence that Gentile is cooking it for herself. But if the record is cooking for you, any time a product is cooked in a Jewish home by a Gentile, unless it's for a specific reason which we know is permissible, the assumption is it's Bishul Akum. Yes.
What about like nuggets, fries, fish sticks, the kinds of things that are like you're getting you want them to get ready for your kids before you get home?
In my La'aniyah Zati, I don't think chicken nuggets is something that you serve the other. If you do, don't have the Gentile cook. They're fully cooked? Okay. There's something else. If they're fully cooked, then certainly no problem. But even if they're not cooked, again, chicken nuggets is designed for little kids. Little kids. You have a meal and you're like, kids not going to eat whether you touch it with. Only eat the nuggets, no matter what you make. Right? I know, kids. Right. So under those circumstances, I think chicken nuggets and fish sticks, I think that's okay.
Beginning
to end, because it's not something which is Ole al Shulchan Melachim. How is that again, that's why I said that the difference between how you're going to prepare the pasta. When the pasta is served, like in the pasta factory, you can, it's undoubtedly subject to Bishul Akum.
You're saying you can make mac and cheese on the stovetop?
The kids, yeah. Use this. Use this as a golden rule. If it's something that you would generally serve only your kids, but not adult company,
then it's okay. If it's something that you would put down in front of a guest, then be worried about it. Yeah.
So, I know we've been over this. If you have a living, they can never cook for themselves.
Yeah. Not cook for themselves something that is subject to bishalachim.
So what if you then put their own pot?
Yeah, you have no problem. You want to have her own pot? She can cook whatever she wants. She can. A guy can cook, if you have one pot that's designed just for her, she can cook whatever she wants and eat it for herself, no problem. No, not...
She can cook chicken with whatever
in that stuff. It's not like kosher product. Your kosher product. If she wants to cook a chicken for herself, you give her one pot. This is your pot to cook chicken. Cook whatever she wants. No, you have to designate a burner.
What about the oven?
Do you have to recosher the oven?
She cooks for herself.
Yeah, tell her to wrap it. Tell her to wrap it. That's all. Like anything else. Tell her to wrap it. Yeah. He's worthless. That's correct. You have to do something in the cooking process. It's the one time in the world it takes to be an Ashkenazi. All the other times it takes to be aspiring. Yes. Oh, that's it. He's the third. He's the dictator. Yeah.
You said before that there were a couple of criteria as to what makes the food kosher. You had said that it has to be something that's cooked, not that you can eat it raw.
And right.
Significant. Is there another criteria that we didn't cook?
No. Yes.
Rice and beans.
Rice and beans is a very sophisticated side dish. Kids don't eat rice and beans. The rice and beans, if you go into that place on West Englewood Avenue, that's, what's the name of that place? The grill, in the middle.
Persian grill.
What?
Persian grill.
Persian grill. Rice and beans, that's the main side dish that they have. Okay. But your husband would also eat that thing.
Well,
people complain, and I say, "How can you?" Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I don't know what Sephardic policy is about relying on that. That's an excellent question. That's an excellent question. What does a Sephardic Jew do about going into a restaurant that somebody owes? That's an interesting question. Yes. Who we owe you? See what their problem is. I don't know. That's kind of a question
that you have over there.
So now that we've determined that pizza bagels are not fully cooked,
right.
In theory, my husband and I can eat a pizza bagel, what do I do about the fact that last week my babysitter made pizza bagels for the kids? Like, what do I
eat? I said, I don't think pizza bagels is something which is Ole al Shulchan Melachim. And
it's
a
we would eat it.
Okay, again, most people would not. It's edible. Yes, that's correct. Forget about the pizza bagels. Yes. Okay, two more questions. Yeah. Yeah.
If a person,
your
brother, is a non-Jew, with a Shalom, when is your, how do you,
after one third cooking, it's halakhically considered cooked. Okay, well, whatever, I know, but not how long it's going to sit there, because it's going to sit there overnight sometimes, but how long it would be considered cooked in a conventional sense. If you were making cholent to serve tonight, how many hours would it take to cook? 3 hours? So after an hour, it's too bad. That's it. Yeah.
A little on the side, but you had mentioned about the other options that you have to make later. What about just something that's fully cooked, like frozen waffles? Can you put that in the oven?
Mita O'Raita, 100% yes. Mita Rabbanan, 100% no. Mita O'Raita, you can't, there's no ain bishol acha bishol. You can't cook something that's already been cooked. On Mita O'Raita level, Mita Rabbanan, yes.
So if I leave my oven on warm, on 170 degrees, and then on my housekeeper plugs in the number, the electric oven, and she plugs in the number 350, and puts in...
That's fine, as long as it's on.
As long as it's on.
That's correct. That's correct. As I said, if that works on a PSE and cheating, that's a safe one. Okay, level time. I hope you have a fairly good understanding of what's happening. We are going to have this type of a shiur once a month. It'll be on a Wednesday, the Wednesday of Shabbat Mevarchim. The normal Wednesday night share is a Mishnah share. You're invited to attend that as well. We're doing Masechet Brachot, where the purpose is not halacha l'maaseh, but to really learn, to do a lot of the Gemara associated with it, and to get your brains to think, to analyze, to challenge, to attack. But once a month, in order to somehow, I see that this is a very popular forum. Right, there will be such. I invite you also to submit topics that you would like to discuss.
So,
it will be the Wednesday night before Shabbos Mubarak. The Wednesday night before Shabbos Mubarak at 8 o'clock. Have a good night. One second. Leah.
Yes.
These are yours. Yes.